Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
This is Rebooting the News.
We're being more dignified today because you're using a dignified computer.
That's right. I have a new MacBook Pro.
It doesn't happen that often that you get an upgrade.
No, it doesn't.
So what did you name the computer?
Good question. I haven't given it a name yet.
Well, you have to.
I know.
You haven't. How could you not have given it a name?
Because I'm waiting for inspiration this time.
But when you boot up the computer, it asks you
to
give it a name.
You know, this is one thing that really impressed me about Apple.
It's called Jay Rosen's computer.
It asked
me. That's really creative.
It asked me to if I wanted to, with FireWire, transfer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. It worked perfectly.
Yeah. It
and
does.
Every single thing worked. Like even my wireless codes and encryption worked.
Well, it's just a disk copy, Jay. I mean, it's not like right.
To me, it was a miracle.
It is kind of a miracle when things like that actually work.
Yeah. I mean, they told me it was going to happen that way, but it was still pretty.
No, I agree. It is. But, you know, sometimes not to dive into too much detail, but sometimes it's not the right thing to do. But in that case, it is. Yeah.
Worked perfectly.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to kind of take it for a test drive and do some things that...
That you never did
maybe
before.
Maybe I hadn't done before, so...
You drank scotch. That's what everybody says. You were operating your computer under the influence of scotch.
So I went on YouTube on Sunday night at 11 o'clock, and I've been trying
to... You had been drinking, too, right?
So I had this glass of scotch, Johnny Walker Black, and...
Do you happen to have one with you right now?
No.
Oh, that's too bad.
And I had been trying to write something about this extraordinary interview that Jon Stewart did with Rachel Maddow.
Yep.
And it didn't work. I didn't have...
Maybe it was the scotch. Maybe too much scotch, you know, the writing. Everybody was giving you crap about the scotch, right?
Yeah.
I'm just their proxy.
It was something that people could seize upon. I recorded this 15-minute interview with my impressions...
With yourself.
Myself. On YouTube.
Yeah.
I put it up on my blog. It's also at youtube.com.
Right.
And it's like a video essay, except that it's a little bit more scattered
it's
than
an essay
would be.
That's what we...
It's a podcast.
That's what a podcast is,
yeah.
Basically. You did a podcast.
Yeah.
It's good.
And...
I watched it. It was very entertaining.
Last night, a lot of people liked it, and they said, hey, I hope you do some more of these. And I'm not sure if I will or not, but...
Why not? Do you know why you should?
Why should
I? Well, first of all, fewer people will listen to it than will skim your blog post, right? But they won't have the ability to skim it. And so for the smaller number of people who will actually listen to it, you'll actually be communicating with them.
Uh-huh.
They'll actually hear you at a pace at which your ideas actually sink in. Because you talk slowly anyway.
I do.
But that was my reason. When I did I used to do Morning Coffee Nets podcasts on scripting.com. And originally I started doing them because I wanted to inspire people to do podcasts because it wasn't happening. And I figured, well, give it a try this way and see if, you know, an amateur like myself doing it might give people the idea. And that worked. But I would do it whenever an idea that I had been blogging about wasn't getting through. They just weren't getting it, you know?
Yeah.
That's because what was happening then is there was just so much stuff to read that people weren't reading anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing was just skimming. And there must be a fair number of people that are doing that with your stuff, too. So if
sure,
you
there
come
always has been, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just the way the web works. And so if you want to sort of, there's an idea that you want at least a few people to actually have it penetrate, do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So like when you have a big idea and you write a post like the one about atomization, okay, a few days after the post runs, then do one of these, you know, and add to it. That way it's like you're a teacher, right? I mean, you do this in front of your class on a regular
teaching.
Basis.
Yes.
It is exactly what it is.
Yes.
And think of the people reading your blog for the big ideas. Think of them as students.
Hmm.
For those big ideas.
That's very interesting because... I had a different idea here, which was I don't have thoughts finished enough for a press think essay the way I do them.
Yeah.
And that this was a way to express more tentative or disconnected thoughts. In
or
the
things
end,
that you wouldn't necessarily want to be quoted on. You said some things in there that, that had you put them in a blog post, might have made, like you said that Stuart was ineloquent or
inarticulate,
right. And you probably wouldn't have written that in a blog post.
I might have. But
you might have, but okay. You might not have, too. But because that would have gotten quoted, where it's very hard for people to quote this.
True.
Because they can't find it in the search engine. that's the other thing, by the way. It gives you a certain amount of cover.
Your idea of defeating skimming, as that does appeal to me.
Yeah. Ultimately, if you're an idea person who wants to communicate, you are, your enemy is skimming. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, this is interesting. Everybody would say that the most important thing in explaining yourself and articulating your ideas is to be clear. And I wouldn't quarrel with that. That is true. However, there are certain subjects, and the debate over within news, objectivity versus subjectivity is one of them, where when people have very well-developed views already, I'm sure you've encountered this in your writing, sometimes what happens is they understand you too quickly, too easily, because they're assimilating what they think you're saying to an existing debate, or right?
Yeah.
And so sometimes the work of ideas is actually to prevent people from understanding you too easily, even though it's also true that there's no virtue in being obscure or trying to make things more complicated than they are. And that's a very tricky thing in teaching as well as writing. Anyway.
In software design, too, by the way. I learned this, and I wrote a piece, I think it was in like 1991, called, it was one of the very first online essays that I wrote, called How to Demo Software for Fun and Profit. And what it was a checklist for people who were going to demo their software at the first demo conference, Stuart Alsop. The demo has now been running for, I don't know, 20 years or something. This was the very first one, and I was sort of the boot camp director for the people who were demoing. And so I wrote a checklist of things that they should be thinking about in terms of their demos. And I said you should always throw one nauseatingly complex idea into the demo.
Right.
Because otherwise people will see your product as being trivial and they'll sniff at it and they'll say, oh, well, he's going to get cloned tomorrow and blah, blah, blah. That happened, you know, when I first shipped my product, my first tech software product, that happened. And at that time, everybody was going for ease of use. That was the big buzzword, and I fell right into the trap. And so I factored and refactored and tested and didn't release the product until it really was pretty transparently easy to use. And then that's what everybody said. Everybody said, trivial product. Where's the product?
Right.
Well, that was actually a compliment. But in marketing and in money raising and, you know, inside the industry, it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So the next release, we put in a feature nobody understood, except we did, and nobody used it.
See, that's not good either.
I said that in my piece, right.
Yeah.
But you should focus on the ones that are useful.
Right.
Don't put too much energy into this. But
yeah, it's a tricky territory.
This was another one, actually. It's very current. A very young guy named Aaron Levy, who runs a company called Box.net, wrote an essay on TechCrunch last week. And I forget the exact way he put it, but it was brilliant. It was the same idea, is that when you're selling enterprise software, in other words, you're selling, like if NYU were to buy some software, ease of use counts for shit. They won't pay for it. Okay, they won't pay a dime for it, even though they should.
Right.
The reason why they won't is because there's no job security in there for the people who are making the buying decision. They like complexity because that justifies their job.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, my God.
Same thing with newspaper content management systems.
Yeah, and it's like doctors who won't buy cures because then you won't need a doctor. that's the scary part is, like, you really don't. There are certain areas where it's always a bad practice.
Yeah.
Right?
Here's a little tidbit you'll love. Back in the early part of the 20th century, AT&T took school groups, teachers and students, on tours of their switching equipment because they were concerned that the telephone was too easy to use and people didn't think it was magical enough. Hmm. And so they had to take them behind the scenes to where the switching occurred,
right,
so that they could remystify something that was just too simple to use.
But I think that's actually healthy, to be, believe it or not. You know, a very small number of students these days take computer science classes. You know that. I mean, it's like, I was told there are like 200 comp sci majors here at NYU with 50,000 students, okay? Now, I think that's wrong. I think that's really, really dangerous.
Well, the undergrads are more like 5,000, but still.
5,000 what?
Undergrads.
Okay. So there still should be more.
Yeah.
Whatever the numbers are. There aren't enough. There isn't enough understanding of and respect for, because this is the technology that basically everything's being rewritten to
yeah.
work around, you know, that people are treating it like it's a given. And eventually, there are going to be some serious problems with this network we're building. And when that happens, people are going to wonder, why didn't anybody tell me about this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you didn't bother to find out. Is mm-hmm. why nobody told you about it. It's like the people in New Orleans. I went to college in New Orleans, and everybody knew that there was a big, there was going to be a big hurricane, and the levees wouldn't hold the water that was coming. And yet, after the fact, of course, all the interviews on the news said, "Well, nobody told us this was going to happen." You know, it's like, come on. You live there and you didn't know this was coming. Give me a
right.
break. Anyway.
Well, to bring it back to my original observation,
yes,
sometimes I want to make sure that I'm not understood too quickly, because if I am, it'll be wrong. And an example of that would be my ideas about the view from nowhere. I don't really say in anything I've written, and I don't believe, that objectivity is just a crock, and it's something, it's impossible, and you should never try for it. And it's, I don't really say that. There's parts of what's called objectivity in journalism that I actually think are very important. For example, trying to see the world as it is and not the way we would like it to be. Not only do I not have a quarrel with that, that's extremely important thing for any journalist to be able to do,
or at least try to do.
Try to do, yeah. But this thing that I call the view from nowhere, I do want to critique that, but I don't want to throw out everything in objectivity. And what happens is that when people see those words, like view from nowhere, they equate that with objectivity. They immediately say, that's the myth of objectivity, and Rosen doesn't believe that. And I learned the importance of doing this from one of my real intellectual guides, Hannah Arendt, who used to take words that are very closely related and that most people treat as synonyms and say, actually, these things are two different things. Mm. We have to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Like an example would be labor and work. She would say, actually, these are completely different things. Let me explain. Right? And by doing that, by taking things that were close but not identical and splitting them apart, she would open up new space for thought. So anyway, that's the idea.
It's very important. And I think sometimes all that we're doing is just exploring our ability to have a conversation where we're actually being understood.
Right. The response, with fine distinctions.
Where the response comes back is, well, I don't agree with you, and here's what I think, as opposed to that's bullshit, and you're wrong, and it's like you can get off track very quickly.
Yes.
And if
so I got a question for you.
Yeah, I know what's coming. Here we go. Okay.
I hear a lot of things, and I'm just wondering, Dave, did you invent RSS?
Oh my God. Anyway, yes. Yes, I did. Next question.
Then you wrote a blog post about this, which was actually very interesting.
I thought it was interesting, too. That's why I wrote it.
And you wrote it because people keep asking you this.
Yeah, well, no, they do and they don't. Sometimes they ask, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just go ahead and say it. And so this always creates it often creates an awkward situation where, what do you want to do? Here are three people. You've just been introduced by one of them to two other people. Or there are four people, myself included.
Right.
And
this is Dave Weiner.
He invented
RSS.
Right. And,
right. And if you say
so
no,
now
you're
what
not
do
not
I say?
Jerk.
Yeah, like yeah. Who cares? You know, split these hairs. You know.
Right.
I mean, are they using it as a shorthand, or are they mistaken,
right.
or do they even care about the distinction? Those are all important questions. And then, what about blogging and podcasting? Why doesn't that get in there too? I think those are important. There's also outlining, which I certainly didn't invent, but I feel that's important, and web content management, and that more or less covers it. There are some other things like OPML and XMLRPC and SOAP and whatnot. There's, you know, it is a scattering of things that I've been involved with, some successful to varying degrees.
Yeah.
And RSS certainly is the one that I'm most frequently credited with, let's put it that way. And so the piece said basically RSS isn't the kind of thing that gets invented. There is no eureka moment. You know, you go, eureka, I just invented RSS. Mm-hmm. Well, it never happened. Mm-hmm. And it couldn't happen. It's not the nature of the beast. It's more like James Burke's series Connections. You know, his thesis, which is really good model for how innovation happens, is that very often people find little scattered things left on the ground and they say, I wonder what I could do with this. Right, and you look at it and you say, all right, let's try this out with it, and something interesting happens that creates something new, and then the next guy comes along, right? And so for a period of probably about 3 years, I took responsibility for RSS and made it my mission to get everybody to use it. That was my thing. I had really good tools at the time for doing that. I had the leading blogging software. I had the leading two aggregators that existed. There were only two, and the other one did us the service of dying, so we had the only one. And I also had a very popular blog. At that time, Scripting News was the number one blog. I mean, it was had the most flow, had the most pointers. It was like, in every way, it was number one. So I had the three ingredients that you needed to actually drive a standard, okay, to create a standard. Even so, there was a ton of fighting. Mm-hmm. But then I saw it through that and saw the opportunity to get it to the next level. And then there was this magic moment when the fighting stopped and mass scale adoption happened and it became a standard. That's something that everybody's argued about. I've always hesitated to say that RSS is a standard because that always starts a huge argument. And mm-hmm. I don't like those arguments, and so I avoid saying it. But I felt it was time now to say it because we need to actually use RSS in some ways. It's a very important technology for the future. And it's important to clean up the past that way. And let's get out past this point where we argue about whether it's a standard or not. Of course it's a standard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the only thing it doesn't have is the tech industry acknowledgement of standards that it likes to convey to these things. There's no IETF endorsement. There's no W3C endorsement.
Right. Well, wasn't the conclusion of your post that you didn't exactly invent it, but you made it a standard?
Right. But go ahead and say I invented it if you want to, because I don't want to argue with anybody. And one of the commenters had a really interesting observation, which is maybe that really closes the book on this, is that how did Bob Metcalf become the inventor of Ethernet? According to Bob Metcalf, he said, well, I just said I was the inventor, and if nobody objected, then I was the inventor. Nobody objected. So I said in this piece, yes, I am the inventor, and not only did nobody object, but some of the people who actually objected in the past threw in the towel in the comments in the post and said, you know what, we see it that way too now. We're not going to fight you on this.
Oh, well, that's a good outcome.
I thought it was a fantastic outcome. It allowed me to say that let's keep the door open for working on stuff together, because, honestly, I think the W3C should still ratify RSS. It should still take that and make it as far as it goes, or the IETF, or both of them, and let them publish the spec as an RFC, and let's get rid of any divisions over this, and let's build more, because there is more to build.
Okay. Now, if I read your post correctly, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, didn't you say that the moment when the New York Times adopted RSS was kind of...
No, it was the moment.
The moment where it became a standard. So,
yes.
So the Times was acting as a kind of arbiter there.
It was, yes. No question about it. I mean, it wouldn't have made a difference had there not already been a lot of users of RSS, that there had not already been blogging, lots of blogging tools that supported it, that there were aggregators. There was this whole confluence of things that was ready for the Times to come in and ratify. Once the Times ratified it, it became an example of the publishing industry doing something that now I understand the publishing industry doesn't do very often, which is work compatibly with each other, which happens to be a feature of the tech industry, too. The industries don't like to get together on things. They fight a lot. Well, and this one was an interesting one because the publishing industry kind of got caught not looking, and they did something that's not in their nature, which is they all agreed on this.
Yeah.
And I realized later, by the way, this is an addendum. This will probably be a post, too, is that they did the same damn thing with Twitter later.
They sort of all agreed to start using it.
But there's a big difference. Twitter is a private corporation, and RSS
is a standard.
Is a view from nowhere. Yeah. It really doesn't have a view.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any ownership. It doesn't have any economic interests.
Right.
It doesn't
carry... No patent.
No business... That's right, no patent. No business model either.
Right, no business model. You know, right.
And no money. Right. I said in another post,
Right. Like, how much did you make off RSS,
man? It's like Facebook without the money, which actually I think is a feature, because Facebook's going to do all this stuff to build that pile of money bigger and bigger and bigger. And that is going to narrow what Facebook does over time, the same way what you're seeing the narrowing of Twitter.
I don't think Zuckerberg's interested in money. He's interested in power.
Well, that's the same thing.
Is it?
I think so. All right. I think that he'll have to narrow the functionality. Well, no, it's irrational for him to be interested in money beyond the amount of money he already has. It's irrational.
It's irrational, but plenty of people
have that
irrational.
I know, but he strikes me as somebody who's kind of middle class.
All right.
Yep. So, did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. Thank you very much. Now, you posted something else that I found very interesting.
I know what this week is, too.
You said the tech industry is a virus.
Yes.
Not has a virus or promotes a virus.
No, it is a virus.
But it is a virus, a relationship of identity. So...
I like you, Jay. That's a mathematical concept.
Yeah,
right there,
equals, right?
It's more than equals. It's triple equals. It's identical, too.
Right.
It's not just equal. 1 + 1 = 2, but 2... is the identical
equals
thing.
With a kicker.
It just is the same thing.
Yeah, is the same thing, right.
Not true here. The tech industry is an instance of a virus. There are viruses that are not the tech industry. So
okay.
It's not an identity. Let's be very clear about this.
All right. I mistook the sentence.
It's
the
okay.
Tech industry is a virus. The tech industry is a virus. So what does that mean? I mean, what are you talking about?
I had this really awful, jarring experience. This morning, I woke up and there were all these articles about Path.com, and I'd been hearing about Path.com and didn't know what it was. They were being very good at sort of keeping it under, you know, wraps about what their actual service was. And turns out Path.com is a very boring idea that's been done many, many times, and who cares? It's a photo sharing app for your iPhone. Big deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because everybody's talking about it, I have to try it. So I download it on my iPhone, fill in the form, enter my name, password, et cetera, et cetera. And then, okay, what do? Now I have to find some people to share my pictures with, right? So
right.
I click on the people tab, and lo and behold, it starts suggesting people. And these are all people I know.
Mm-hmm.
They're all people that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
I go, how the hell did they know all that? How did they know these people? And I thought, oh, I get it. These are all people who have already followed me on Path.com.
Right.
And I was smiling. Oh, I can't believe that person. Oh, they thought to follow me. Isn't that nice? I get down to 8 levels, 8 down, and then I see somebody who probably hasn't signed on the internet in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, this person is not an early adopter. There's something wrong with my mm-hmm. theory. So I go over to Twitter and I say, what the hell? How do they know all these things? You know? And then this guy posts a tweet which says something that is, in hindsight, totally obvious. Oh, they just read your address book on your iPhone. And I go, oh, my God, they did what?
They How read your dare address they? Book. Who said they could do that?
Right. That was my next lie.
Yeah.
Who said, where did I say they could do that? And what else did they do with it? I tried to think of an analogy so that it explained why I'm so outraged. And I said, well, it would be like standing on a subway platform,
uh-huh.
and all of a sudden a person behind you starts reading off the credit numbers on your credit card.
Oh, MasterCard, huh,
and
Dave?
You turn around, and they got your wallet. They're holding your wallet. And the question is, has the damage already been done? And yes, the answer is absolutely the damage has been done. There's nothing more.
So how do they do this? Apple gives it to them?
There's a file on the iPhone that contains your contacts. They read the file. Now, did they upload it to their servers? If I were them, you know what? This is where we get down to what the identity part of the thing. And you know what? This is the lunacy of the tech industry. This is how incredibly, I don't know what the corrupt might be the right word. It's like, it's just, it's a spammer's thing. They're just like, everything is a scam. Everything is trying to get you to give them all your data so then they can sell it to somebody else. So what is
that? So in this case, who are they selling it to?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
That person who got my wallet, who are they selling my credit card numbers to?
Right.
I don't know.
The Russian mob, usually.
Right. The point is that this is what the tech industry has become.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is a scam to try to get you to give them your information so that then they can sell it. So it's sort of like there's two ways to do business. One is a really sneaky, spamming sort of scammer, viral. They even call it viral, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
they can't really argue with whether they're virus. They say they are,
mm-hmm.
right? You could do it that way, or you could charge money. There aren't really, don't seem to be anything in between.
Right.
Right? And in this case, this is what was so incredibly aggravating about this was the iPhone is the latter. I paid a lot of money for that thing.
Yeah, right.
I pay a lot of money every month for that
thing.
It's
not like you're free lying.
I'm not anybody's business model here. My data doesn't belong to anybody, nor could they justify taking it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not theirs. I didn't enter it into their system. And plus, I paid to use this thing. This is my microphone. You know what
okay.
I mean? So it's like absolutely. Now, this piece hit a nerve because there's a lot of people pointing to it and talking about it, and people even in the tech industry thanking me for writing
it. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice. Well, if I could pull the camera back a little bit.
Wait, let me just say one more thing.
Yeah.
Okay? You are going to see a deluge of these in the next 2 or 3 days because there's a conference out in California, the Web 2.0 Summit, which is where they announce all these things. And you know, Jay, there has been a huge boom in angel investing.
Mm-hmm.
You know that? I mean, it's like it's another bona fide tech bubble,
mm-hmm.
And so they are constantly generating a stream of these virus-like companies.
Huh.
So you have to really
expect
be careful.
More.
You have to be careful whenever you install an app on your iPhone. Now we know that now, and that was not supposed to be the case. You also cannot. You give your Twitter credentials to anybody.
I hate doing that. Yeah.
You can't do it.
I'm not doing it.
Don't do it,
yeah.
Okay, because they can read your direct messages.
I always stop at that moment.
Yeah. And then you have to worry about what Twitter Corporation is doing, because even if you don't give your credentials to anybody else, you've given every piece of text you write in there, even if it was just intended to be read by one person,
yeah.
is readable by their computers. So.
Yeah. Well, let me pull back a minute.
Sure.
You and I both know Terry Heaton, who is former television news person, actually, who's now gone into trying to redirect the news industry as a consultant. And he's also a blogger and a thinker with some serious new media chops. And he wrote a piece recently about the advertising business. And the point he makes has been made by Doc Searls also, that the whole idea of sending people unwanted messages because you want to is actually in peril and deserves to be in peril. Because You don't have any right to do that. It just happens to be a huge industry that grew up through the previous media platform, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people say that, well, we're used to that and we don't mind the interruptions and all this stuff. But in fact, most people don't want unwanted messages beamed at them for purposes of some other guy, right? And I think that this is actually cutting out the whole basis of the traditional advertising industry. This is why Doc has developed his idea of vendor relations management, which is intended to replace advertising, which is a very interesting idea. But if this is true, if the basis for the advertising business, which is the advertiser's right to beam unwanted messages at us, is eroding, then there's only two other ways to get money in media. One is directly subscriptions, and the other is data.
Or maybe we don't need the intermediaries. You know, this is the thing I keep.
The other possibility is collapse. Yeah.
Well, you see, we talked about this in D.C. Right? I mean, it's like they get us to look at everything from their point of view. Collapse is that's how it would look if you were inside their cloud. Okay.
From the outside, this is why they're doing these things because they fear collapse.
Right. And the thing about it, there's another competing force here as well, is that people actually seek out commercial information all the time. All right. I want to buy a new set of grapes.
Yes, but for their own reason.
That's correct.
Right.
In other words, and that's what
Doc is going.
Well, I know, and me too. We've been talking about this all three many years.
Right.
That's what advertising has to compete with.
Right.
Right? And for the advertiser, there's going to be a moment of revelation when they realize their money is better spent in providing the information people are actually seeking in a more useful manner.
Right. Right? But you've got this huge industry that's totally wrapped up in it.
But it's an industry
blitzing people with messages
that the rest of us probably won't miss when
no,
it goes away.
Not at all.
Right, exactly.
We won't even miss it for a day.
And the tech industry has, you know, tech isn't necessarily about this, right? I mean, you know, look at the room we're in right now. There's an awful lot of technology in here.
Yeah.
I don't see any ads.
Right, we don't need it.
They haven't stolen my address book off my Mac on any of these things. Now, somebody paid for these devices here, right? The trustees of NYU or whoever it is that writes the checks.
Right.
They did it after getting a lot of commercial information that wasn't advertised to them. They went out and sought it. Right. Adrian, did you buy these things? Did you spec them? No? Well, somebody did. And there's a lot of commerce that happens, and we don't need advertising, and we won't miss it.
Advertising is a way of renting your brain without paying you for it.
The tech industry, as it exists, had better find another way to do things, because this bubble's going to burst, and it's going to burst real soon. I'll tell you why, because I could have written that piece 2 years ago, and nobody would have paid any attention, and they would have said, oh, he's just being a stinker, that's Dave, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, that ain't what happened today. That what happened is very different, and the tech industry ought to take note of that, because they're creating an explosion of these companies with these viral business models, and the demand for them is just dropping enormously. People are hip to it, and they're scared, and they don't want to install these things. So,
we got two other stories I want to get in before our 45 minutes is up.
Yeah.
One is extraordinary thing that the staffers at Newsweek.com did today. They posted on their Tumblr that the merger, which is going to fold Newsweek.com into the Daily Beast, Tina Brown's online operation, makes no sense, and that they ought to be able to continue with Newsweek.com if Newsweek, the print magazine, is also going to continue. And listen to some of the things they say on their Tumblr about their own company as they fight back against this plan to fold their site into the Daily Beast. They say, it would only be fitting that its website would be the first to go. Like most print publications, Newsweek magazine has been led by people who deep down don't understand the web, and because they don't understand it, they fear it and don't value it. Newsweek.com may have always remained an ugly stepchild to its print grandparents, who were too busy burning money to notice. And they openly say it would be stupid to close down Newsweek.com because it helps build the print brand. And the Daily Beast is not going to do that. You're just going to kind of let that reputation evaporate. Anyway, it's you rarely see the .com or web side of the news operation openly say what I often say, which is that the print guys don't know and they don't want to know.
Right.
And here it bursts into public view, which I just thought was...
Well, it was like a last gasp, right? I mean...
What do they have to lose?
Nothing to lose, right?
Meanwhile, what an example of sources going direct. I don't know if you caught this, but if our listeners go to my 40 Twits page, which is j.40twits.com, which is the 40 recent links I pushed out through my Twitter feed and the number who clicked on all of them, you'll see that far outdistancing everything else is this post by an ordinary would-be flyer who...
I read the piece, every word in the piece.
It was amazing. So he goes to the airport.
They wouldn't
in San
even
Diego.
Let him leave after they denied him access.
So they say to him that he's got to go through this X-ray scanner that basically allows people to look at you under your clothes, and he doesn't want to do that.
And therefore, they're
going to have to pat him down, including like grabbing his crotch. He refuses to do that. He says, I'll be happy to go through the regular metal detector that everyone else is going through, but they say no. And he's got the presence of mind to record this on his phone. And he's recording video and audio of the TSA agents. And when I read this, I said, man, this thing is going to go viral, and I'm going to help it go viral. And it already is. And last week I had read an article in the New York Times about this very issue of people getting angrier and angrier about what some people call security theater. Security theater means
right.
It doesn't really have that much to do with making us safer. It's the government's way of impressing upon us how much they're doing to make us safer, right?
Yep.
And it's become a major hassle, and of course the people in charge are out of control in many ways. So here's an example of somebody who would be an excellent source for a kind of trend article on passengers getting more and more frustrated, right? Who instead goes direct, posting his experiences, posting the video and audio, and it tears across the internet like wildfire. Now, what a smart journalist would do would be to pick up on this post, note how much traction it's getting, and then take it to the TSA, take it to the government, get a response, make somebody in the government read this post, right, and give a response. That's what journalists cued in.
But that is happening. That will happen more and more.
I think it will happen.
You want to say something, Adrian?
It's illegal, though, to videotape in that area.
Oh. Well, but we'll overlook that one. We're glad he did, aren't we?
Well,
Adrian said it's illegal.
Maybe it is illegal, but his protection now is that viral nature of...
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, I got to say that Fortune asked if they could have permission to run my Tech Industry as a Virus piece, which is an absolutely appropriate place for it to run. I said yes, and it's now there. So,
cool.
So sometimes you do see these things get picked up. We need to see, as I think you agree, a lot more of that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the stories come to you however they come to you.
Right.
You shouldn't argue with that, and, you know.
But
It wouldn't have been anywhere near as good if he was just a quote in an article. You needed to hear the whole narrative. He told a great story. I mean, it was riveting. You read sentence after sentence. You wonder where this is going next.
Right.
And there were some funny twists in there, like
right
the guy coming over as he's leaving the airport.
That really made it.
I mean, why?
Amazing,
what is the rationale for saying you can't leave the airport?
Right.
I mean, did they really think there was a bomb in his genitals? I mean, That was the question. He said, well, you can't leave them until we find out whether or not there is a bomb in your whatever.
Right.
And, okay.
Uh-huh. Are you actually going to arrest me? Because if you're not going to arrest me, I'm going to walk out this terminal door right now. Yeah.
And there is this whole concept of the Constitution and right to not be, you know, what is it, search and seizure. And
well, just the whole idea that an agent of the government was telling you he's going to grab your crotch in order to search you is kind of astounding.
Well, you know, if there really is some cause to say that this person is breaking the law, you know, or if it is, I mean, you could say, but the guy's walking out of the airport, he's not going to be a danger to anybody if he has a bomb.
No probable cause.
There's no cause to that. It's it's like when you call a vendor and you know, you're wondering where is, you know, you said this was going to be ready on Saturday, here it is Wednesday, it hasn't shown up, and they put you on hold and you have to listen to this tape over and over thanking you for your patience and saying we're coming right back, and then they play music and then 5 seconds later they say thank you for your being so patient, we're sorry for the inconvenience. All of this is like institutional aggravation. It's like they hired a consultant to find out how they could be more aggravating.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, you know.
Well, my point is that there's a beat reporter who covers transportation safety for the New York Times. There's a blog at USA Today that's all about the business of travel, frequent travelers, right? Those guys should be on this Monday morning.
Right.
It broke over the weekend. They should be on
it. Maybe they are. Let's hope.
Well, let's hope. There should be a story about it today.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Gawker is on it because Gawker knows how to follow what's viral on the web, right?
No.
And just by looking at my 40 Twits page, you know, I'm a small, tiny fraction of traffic.
But obviously, the story has legs.
Right, it's got to be.
It's got 4,000 clicks.
Yeah.
4,500
clicks.
The next one has 1,800.
Right. So that tells you something. Just that, the ratio tells you something.
Yeah. Yeah.
The sources are going direct. People know how to do it. Nobody had to tell this guy what to do. You know, he narrated his experience, and it's 10 times more effective than a trend story.
Yep. Yeah. Because it's a story.
Yeah.
So what else we got? Anything else?
One other thing that really interested me. It's sort of a follow-up to my View from Nowhere post. And it's a little editor's note from an editor at National Geographic who is praising one of his photographers for some photos that she took of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is a breakaway sect of the Mormons that believes in polygamy, right? And what he manages to say in this little three-paragraph note is stuff about photography that I find amazing, amazingly naive and sort of fundamentalist. He says, the best photographers understand the obligation that comes with the privilege of access to otherwise hidden worlds. Stephanie understands that others may want to pass judgment, but that is not her role. She photographs what she sees and provides the opportunity for insight. The rest is up to the reader. And people have voices and agenda, but we believe in the unbiased presentation of facts. And what this guy is trying to suggest is that a photographer can provide a picture of a news scene without any judgment whatsoever. And he really believes that. And I think that is a complete illusion. Now, I do think it's true
90 seconds
that a photographer doesn't have to have a stance on the issue of polygamy, right? And that is not necessarily encoded in her photographs. But the idea that photographs just tell stories without judgments, they are without any sort of human intervention, they are simply, you know, records of what happened, and the photographer stands back, is just a fantastic delusion.
Well, they've also never heard of Photoshop. I mean, Photoshop is the
well,
ultimate.
Well, there's that also.
Right? I mean, just that's what I think of when people start talking about photography and how, I mean, you know, where the rubber meets the road on this is how much can you trust the photography, right? I mean, it doesn't matter whether the guy's, you know, pure in spirit. What matters to us as people who are viewing it is, should I trust it? And the answer is, especially with photography, you should be circumspect because it's all subject to manipulation.
Right. And if I'm going to trust it, it's not because there is no judgment.
But if you have three pictures that all show the same thing, then you start to trust it a little bit, right?
That's triangulation.
There you go. Right. That's triangulation. Exactly. So, obviously not. But that's it. We're 10 seconds from the end of this Rebooting the News. And
good show, Dave. See you next week.
Right on.
Bye.